The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
So we know that if you have a company that wants to ship goods, things like rail lines and roads are infrastructure. But if you don't have childcare, if you don't have the ability to look after kids when they should be in school but aren't because they're home because of COVID, you don't have the infrastructure you need around you to get to work. So the care economy is what we could call soft infrastructure. You've got the hard infrastructure of roads, bridges, broadband. You know, broadband wasn't considered infrastructure 100 years ago because it didn't exist. And so it matters what we define as infrastructure as what's necessary to get the economy moving.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back and good afternoon. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. The audio you just heard was Senator Kirsten Gillibrand explaining to Fox News why she said child care is infrastructure. It might be infrastructure week. There are indications, I should say, that a bipartisan deal has been reached among a small group of senators. Here to discuss that deal, plus the implications for infrastructure, and maybe even a few of the definitions of infrastructure, is David Ditch, policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org. He focuses on federal spending and fiscal policy. He's also a research associate in the Herman Center for the Federal Budget. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So first off, let's just talk about the deal as we understand it so far. It's pretty ambiguous so far. 10 members of the Senate, 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, have gotten together on this package. And there seems to be some indication that they have gotten to a deal that has eluded everybody else. Of course, President Joe Biden and Senator Shelley Moore Capito had been negotiating a deal, and those talks fell apart about a day or so before this got announced. Where are we at? Does this look like it's a solid deal, or is this still sort of ambiguous and not clear as to whether or not it's going to ever become a proposal?
This is, I would say, more on the ambiguous side of things. What they've released so far is some what you might call top-line spending numbers, but they haven't unpacked what all spending would be included. They've given a vague sense of how they're going to pay for it, and it isn't clear whether there would be bipartisan support for how they want to pay for it, or at least sufficient bipartisan support to get through both chambers of Congress, because right. You've got, you know, some, you know, big demands from the progressive wings on the Democratic Party in both chambers. You've got conservatives who aren't looking for a bunch of new spending and taxes in both chambers. And even some of the more moderate members, like Senator Blunt of Missouri, have voiced skepticism about this proposal. One aspect of the proposal is that it would increase the gas tax for the first time in a couple decades.
Right.
Practically no one wants to be raising taxes in general, let alone taxes that disproportionately affect middle and lower class households.
You know, David, this is interesting, too, because it's also not necessarily a propitious time to be raising the gas tax in particular. And just to back up here for just a little bit, the gas tax is usually how transportation is funded. And, of course, a great deal of this infrastructure is transportation-related. Some of it is not. And, again, we had Senator Gillibrand's description of what she defines as hard infrastructure and soft infrastructure. But it is sort of the traditional fundraising apparatus for transportation-related infrastructure, roads, bridges, those types of things. And the problem with raising the gas tax at the moment is that it tends to be inflationary. And I think this is something that people don't realize when they're looking at the gas tax. Gas tax has not been raised at the federal level anyway since 1993. Now, various states have various different levels of gas taxes as well. They're very high in some states. California comes to mind. They're very low in other states, especially in the Midwest. But states have their own gas taxes. They may have gone up or down in the meantime as well. But there hasn't been an increase since 1993 at the federal level. When you start increasing the gas tax, it has the same impact economically as rising gas prices in general, which is that it tends to be a force multiplier for inflation, because that becomes a tax that essentially gets paid on every leg of a manufacturing distribution channel. And what I mean by that, and I'm sure David's going to have a little bit more context for this, is that you have to bring resources to manufacturers to manufacture their products. That means you have to transport them. Usually that involves buying gasoline. Then you have to take it from the manufacturer to the wholesale. That transportation adds on, gasoline tax. Then from the wholesaler to the retailer, and in some cases, now that we're very much an online economy, from the retailer to your front door, all of that adds up if you're raising gas taxes. And right now, we're already seeing a lot of inflationary pressures. This is probably something that isn't going to be very beneficial if it gets applied in any sort of meaningful way here.
One of the important things that I frankly is never discussed in the media, and as a result, very few people realize, is that the original deal for why we have a federal gas tax in the first place was to pay for the interstate highway system, which was the most important infrastructure project in American history, maybe even the world history, for how much value and how much importance there is in what, the moving goods and people coast to coast and border to border. But sometime around the early 1980s, a lot of that deal changed. Congressional Democrats were able to sort of hold the highway funds hostage and demand a big cut be reserved for urban transit systems, which then and through today only transport a couple percent of people, whether you're looking in terms of trips, whether you're looking in terms of miles traveled, but they get about 20% of the highway fund. And because of all that extra spending, the highway fund went from having a surplus to now it has a deficit and requires constant bailouts. We wouldn't need to worry about the gas tax in trying to hike it if it wasn't for all the money getting sucked out of it to pay for the transit, which, by the way, doesn't pay back into the fund itself. It's a pure, transferring money from people who live in rural and suburban areas to pay for transportation in urban areas.
Right, and there's all sorts of different problems with that, and we've seen some projects that are tremendously poorly constructed. For instance, the California high-speed rail system, I think some of the money for that, some of the federal money for that, I think, came out of that. I think some of it came out of the 2009 stimulus as well, if I remember correctly. Is that correct?
That is correct, and unfortunately, it was just announced that the Biden administration, President Trump had decided to cancel some of the federal funds for the California project because the delays were astronomical, the cost increases were astronomical. It was such a bad deal. Trump administration said, let's cut this off now. The Biden administration's going back and saying, okay, we're going to give them this, roughly $1 billion back so they can build this tiny stretch of rail that connects two very small cities in the middle of nowhere in California. It's ridiculous, but the mindset of the Biden administration is to spend, and not worry so much about the value we get from it.
Yeah, and so that's the reason why what we're talking about in infrastructure matters. It's the reason why the definition matters. And again, we're speaking with David Ditch from the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org. We're taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And that's been a lot of the argument in Congress right now as to what is defined as infrastructure, what is not defined as infrastructure. The more recent proposals seems to have narrowed that down somewhat. The original proposal from the White House was expansive, let's just say, in terms of what was defined as infrastructure. It does seem that they're narrowing this down now a little bit more closely to what we would normally call maybe traditional definitions of infrastructure. I would say rather than looking at it as hard and soft, I think what you're looking at, or what we should, how we should be looking at this, is what is public infrastructure, what is private infrastructure, and public infrastructure is legitimate for public funding. Private infrastructure probably should be handled by the private industries that use it or the private individuals who want to structure that for themselves. This is a little bit more focused on public infrastructure, but what all is in this new proposal? And again, knowing that it's ambiguous, David, but from what we're hearing, what are they including in this bipartisan proposal?
So the core of the proposal is continuing and expanding the what they call the highway bill programs. So that's interstate highways, interstate roads and bridges. It's Amtrak. It's urban subsidies for urban transit.
Right.
And then probably they'll fold in some funding for airports. And beyond that, it's really hard to say because they haven't released all the details.
Well, and again, I mean, we can object to the rail elements of this, especially the light rail elements within cities, which really aren't a federal. I mean, shouldn't be a federal jurisdiction, but it has been traditionally, as you've said, for the last few decades, for that to be part of this. It is still a narrowed down list, and it looks like it's on a scale that is probably going to be more likely to be passed than the previous scales were. In looking at this, let's talk about how the American public is perceiving this, right? I mean, I think that there's a fairly general, if again, sort of vague consensus that we have not been, we need to do more investment in the roads and bridges type of infrastructure. And I live in Twin Cities, and of course the bridge collapse in 2007 was one of the catalysts for this discussion. It's been one of the catalysts for this discussion for the last 14 years. And I think that that's still sort of the impression that American voters have, is that we just really need to start putting more into repairing what we've already got. How accurate is that? I mean, Heritage does a lot of this type of analysis. Is it time to start sinking quite a bit of money into this infrastructure to bring it up to date?
I think there is a lot of potential to be had from improving our public infrastructure, whether it is repairing what we already have, expanding infrastructure in the growing parts of the country. The key is, if we're going to spend the money, it's about, you know, what is the cost and what is the benefit? Infrastructure,
right,
at the end of the day, needs to be a practical consideration. It's like a car. You need a car to get from point A to point B. Do you need a Rolls Royce to get from point A to point B? Probably not. You can get by with a Chevy or a Honda. It's the same thing with infrastructure. You can gold plate any project under the sun with all these different perks for different political constituencies that jack up the cost without,
right,
at the end of the day, helping the public. And when the federal government gets involved, there's all this red tape that increase the costs. There's all these reviews that mean that the projects take years and years and years to ever get started, which also reduces the value. And worst of all, the federal government makes it harder for state and local governments and the private sector to do their own infrastructure investing, which is why then everyone looks to the federal government. It's really a vicious cycle. What we should be doing is getting rid of a lot of the red tape and a lot of the obstructions to non-federal infrastructure spending. Let these other groups that can do the work faster and more efficiently do it. And then we don't need to worry about adding to the debt or jacking up the business taxes or jacking up the gas tax.
We're speaking with David Ditch of the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Let's go to the phones. We have Sophia in Houston. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Doing great, Sophia. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I have a question about the bipartisan proposed deal that you said earlier on might be close to coming to be reached. Earlier, I think this year, Pete Buttigieg was appointed as the Director of Transportation, or the guy in charge of transportation for the country. Secretary, thank you. And he had mentioned or made a proposal to consider taxing American citizens or just people driving the roads based off of miles traveled. as a way to supplant possibly the gas tax. And I was just curious, you know, how that fits into this agreement that might be close to being reached. And then also, how do you think that's going to affect the American public and also subsequent domino effects within oil and gas industry and agriculture, infrastructure, like everything? Just curious what your thoughts are.
It's a great question, Sophia. And I know that David's probably going to have some thoughts on this as well. What Pete Buttigieg, Secretary Buttigieg, was saying, and he's the Secretary of Transportation, this is not a new proposal. It's not a new idea, I should say. I don't think it's ever been formally proposed. It was brought up a few times during the Obama administration, but it turned out to be such an unpopular idea that it more or less sat on the shelf, which was to either replace the gas tax with a mileage tax or to add a mileage tax to the already existing gas tax, in part because, oddly enough, and it's going to sound a little strange, but the federal requirements for gas efficiency with internal combustion engines has been so successful that it has actually held down revenues of gas tax because we're getting better gas mileage from our cars. And so the gas tax hadn't grown as much as people had projected it to be, and they were looking for ways to make up the shortfall. And as of course, if we start transitioning to electric cars, and that's something that this administration is certainly setting as a goal, then the gas tax becomes even less of a revenue raiser, and you have to find ways to replace that. David, I mean, this is an idea. It keeps popping up. It keeps getting shot down because it's unpopular. It's also intrusive because you would have to either trust people to give them your accurate mileage per year with a big bill at the end of it, or you'd have to start tracking people's cars, and there's all sorts of privacy implications for that.
Yeah, the logistics of implementing a vehicle miles traveled tax is very daunting, especially at the federal level. It could be a really big imposition. There's a lot of state governments that are working on projects. Frankly, I think the last thing we should do is try to roll this out nationwide, do a one-size-fits-all, you know, attempt. I will say that, from what I can tell, the bipartisan proposal does not include the vehicle miles travel tax. I do not think you would see, I don't even know, frankly, how many Democrats would support it.
Right.
I know that essentially no Republicans would be on board with that. And because, I won't go into all the details, but the highway bill needs to get passed on a bipartisan basis. It can't be, you know, sort of railroaded by one party. And your vehicle miles travel tax would make it impossible to reach a deal with Republican support. So I really don't think we're going to see that.
I don't think we're going to see it either. It is something that keeps coming up. Sophia is right. This does keep coming up. I believe that Secretary Buttigieg actually did bring it up recently. It is one of these ideas that percolates among a very select group of people, but has very little appeal outside of it. But we are going to keep hearing about this, David, as electric vehicle use expands and the sales of gasoline declines. You're going to start seeing more and more of this talk, I think.
That's absolutely correct. Over the next couple decades, that is going to be an ongoing debate, and I appreciate people asking about it because it's important for people to be aware of it and to think about whether they're comfortable with the idea.
Think about whether you're comfortable with the idea of either having to have a tracking device, having to pay at the end of the year, or do you pay as you go? The gas tax is easy because you pay as you go. You pay it every time you go to the pump, and you don't have a big bill at the end of the year. A mileage tax would be something that would be a rather big jolt at least once a year. You'd have to almost do it quarterly as sort of in the same basis that you do self-employment tax.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people I see sort of hyping the idea, and part of why they like it is it allows for lots of sort of fiddling with the price and sort of trying to micromanage people's travel usage, their
right.
use of the roads. And again, there are some cases where you might want to charge more in certain cases, like to prevent a lot of congestion inside cities, but we definitely shouldn't be making those sorts of decisions at the federal level. The transportation needs and the way we should pay for transportation are going to vary wildly throughout the country.
We are speaking with David Ditch of the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org, about the infrastructure bill, the debate over the infrastructure bill. We've got a couple of minutes left here, David. Where do you think these negotiations are going to lead? I think that there's desire in both parties to pass some sort of infrastructure funding. I think some sort of substantial infrastructure funding. I think it might not even now be an issue of what you define as infrastructure and how much you're going to spend on it. I think the parties have actually gotten pretty close on that point. It's how you pay for it and how you account for the spending that is the real tripwire here. And do you think that that's something that can also be overcome?
Honestly, I'm not surprised to see the bipartisan proposal come together. And again, sort of the broad strokes are about what I would have expected. However, as you said, it is all about how you pay for it, because it's very easy for Congress to give out goodies to their interest groups and just run up the national credit card. The credit card's already been run up. The national debt is around $220,000 per household. So when you actually have to pay for the proposals and look at raising taxes, then suddenly you start to get a little more curious about what the proposals are and whether they're worth the money. And to be honest, I'm seeing a lot more pushback about the costs of these infrastructure proposals than I was expecting a couple years ago. And a lot of that has to do with, again, how much we've added to the national debt because of COVID. And it starts to get really risky to run it up any further than it is.
Right.
And again, and when you break down how expensive it is, I really don't think it's going to be worth the cost.
David Ditch from the Heritage Foundation, thank you so much for being with us for some infrastructure talk. We'll see how that turns out. Coming up next, we'll talk about tax rates and ProPublica's big scoop. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
We think it is in the public interest to know that Jeff Bezos, the world's richest person, paid zero in income tax in two recent years, that Michael Bloomberg paid zero, Carl Icahn paid zero, Elon Musk in 2018, zero taxes. I defy anyone, one, to say, like, this is old news and we're all jaded and the rich can avoid taxes. I think no one would have thought that this was the case until yesterday when we published it.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew and taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. That was ProPublica defending their leak of private tax return data, which is protected by law. They were defending that leak to CNBC. 25 tax returns, tax returns for 25 individuals leaked to ProPublica by an unnamed IRS official, and purporting to show how the rich pay no taxes. I don't think it's news to most people that the wealthy sometimes don't show their wealth in income. But in truth, if you look at the broader set of data, as Chris Edwards from Cato Institute has, the truth is actually somewhat different than what ProPublica is declaring. Chris Edwards joins us today. He's the Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute and editor of the website downsizinggovernment.org. He's a top expert on federal and state tax and budget issues. And before joining Cato, he was a senior economist with the Congressional Joint Economic Committee, a manager with PricewaterhouseCoopers, and an economist with the Tax Foundation. And Chris, I read your piece at Cato, and I thought that I read that, and I thought, why didn't ProPublica just take the same data that you were looking at?
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for having me today. You know, if anyone's interested, you could just go to the IRS site, and the IRS publishes statistical data of people at different income levels. Of course, they strip all the names off their returns and they summarize. But so, for example, the IRS publishes data on the top 0.001% of Americans with the highest income. That's about 1,400, the top 1,400 people. And I'm sure just about all of the people that ProPublica published tax returns on would be in that small group of 1,400 people at the very top. So the IRS says that those people at the top have an average income tax rate of 22.9%. But the selected group that ProPublica published data on, they claim that the tax rate was only about 15%. So, you know, I trust the IRS to summarize the statistical data, which they've been doing for years. And so my piece at Cato is I looked at data from the IRS. I looked at data from the Official Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation, the Tax Policy Center, a center-left think tank in D.C., and the Congressional Budget Office. All four of those authoritative sources show that people at the top pay much higher tax rates than people in the middle or the bottom. So that's what I trust those sources. I don't trust the ProPublica data.
So let's unpack this a little bit. We've been talking about the ProPublica data quite a bit this week, we've been approaching it from the basis of its the scandal that this is. When you file a tax return, the IRS is required by law to protect your individual data because it is private, and you submit it under the understanding that nobody outside the IRS can access this information. It's one reason why we are, well, I don't want to say we're encouraged to be honest, Chris. Clearly we're compelled to be honest here, but it is part of that contract, if you will. And we're compelling you to be honest about this. In exchange, we're going to make it a criminal offense to release any of this information without your consent, unless it is involved in some sort of criminal investigation or civil investigation into tax fraud. Then, of course, obviously, investigators are going to be able to access this. That's not what happened with these 25 25 filers, I should say. I'm not sure how many tax returns there were involved. There were 25 people that leaked the returns from 25 people, and I think there were multiple returns for some of these people whose data was exposed. And that is in itself a crime. On top of that, Chris, you've got somebody in the IRS who's leaking this, not because they're alleging that these people committed crimes, which might have an excuse for whistleblowing, but because they just didn't like the policies which produced the results that are in these tax returns. And that is dangerous. You've got government, you've got a government employee who is violating people's privacy and breaking the law, not in order to manipulate public policy in a way that benefits his own agency. I mean, that to me, first off, is the top line issue here with ProPublica's scoop.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. Yeah, there are two things to think about here, I think, which are really dangerous. One is, if this sort of thing gets routine, I mean, ProPublica should absolutely not have published this, even if someone sent it to them in a blank envelope. It was very irresponsible to publish it, because then it's going to encourage more IRS employees to steal more information and just start leaking it all over the place. You can imagine political warfare if this gets worse down the road, administrations and staffers who are Democrat or Republican or socialist or whatever, leaking returns for people they don't like, Hollywood stars, rich people, political opponents. It is a very dangerous thing to go down that route. That would make us become a banana republic. The other thing I think people should think about is that, you know, the IRS, all the personal information that the IRS holds for us, I've written about this before at Cato. It is, the IRS has always had problems with their computer systems. They've had problems with hacks before where data has escaped. And if you were a hostile foreign government, say in Russia or China, you know, where would you go to try to hack and get personal information on Americans? The IRS would be a wonderful target. So it's very dangerous that this government agency has all this data on us, both from the point of view of leaks and for the point of view of hacks. And this raises, you know, one of the Biden administration proposals is to give the IRS a lot more funding and more power to be able to get data, for example, from our bank accounts. This is one of the proposals. I think that's very dangerous, giving the IRS even more power and grabbing even more of our personal data and storing it on their computer system in Washington.
We're speaking with Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute. He's the editor of the website downsizinggovernment.org, and I believe the Cato Institute is cato.org. Is that right, or is it catoinstitute.org?
It's cato.org, yep.
Cato.org. People don't remember this, or maybe some people remember, but I don't know that a lot of people remember this, but part of the Watergate articles of impeachment was an accusation, I think, that was later at least somewhat validated, which was that the Nixon administration was using IRS return data in just the way that you're talking about right now. And it was
That's absolutely right. And indeed, it doesn't stop there. Other admins, this has been an issue for quite a long time. During the 90s, when I first started working on some of these issues, there was a problem of IRS employees going and fishing for interesting tax returns of celebrities and this sort of thing. And there was a lot of abuse going on in the IRS in the mid-90s, and that actually led up to, there's a landmark reform in 1998, an IRS reform bill that gave that tried to make things more secure and gave taxpayers more rights because there was a lot of IRS abuse at the time. Unfortunately, so these things go in cycles. Unfortunately, we've seen repeated abuses over the years. You know, a decade ago under Obama, there was the abuse that Lois Lerner headed the section that dealt with nonprofit tax returns that the IRS received. And, you know, she seemed to be leaking and preventing nonprofit groups from getting status and the like. So she was politically meddling using IRS tools. So this has been going on for decades, unfortunately. And, you know, both members of Congress and both parties ought to be on top of this and cracking down. It serves neither party for these sort of abuses to go on. They would both lose and we would all lose. So there's got to be steps taken here.
And again, we're talking with Chris Edwards from the Cato Institute. We're taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149, if you'd like to join the conversation. The second part of this, even before we get to the data, because I do want to get back to the data and what the actual data shows, is that when you have these types of leaks, and they are purporting to show a certain reality, the type of data that you get from these leaks is almost always going to be very, very biased. And I wrote about this today, and I was likening it to a public opinion poll with only asking 25 people. And likely if you did that, I mean, certainly it's not going to be representative. And second, you're probably only going to pick the 25 people whose opinions you already know, and that way you can present a very twisted form of reality and claim that, you know, this is representative of the whole. We see that with push polling, and polling, I think, is just the easiest way to, is the easiest analog for this. Whoever leaked this took 25 people and is saying that this is representative of how the wealthy pay their taxes. And it's just that in itself should have raised red flags at ProPublica in terms of the veracity of, first off, the veracity of the claims, and also the scope in which you could actually report this. Other than just reporting Jeff Bezos only paid this in, you know, X year, there's really not much. There's not much you can glean from 25 people's tax returns that's representative of the entire system.
That's right. And that my blog at Cato.org yesterday, I compare what these 25 tax returns supposedly show with data from four authoritative sources that are overall averages, and they have leaked the information on very atypical returns. And by the way, I mean, yeah, I think they mentioned that Bezos, you know, he paid no tax 1 year, but as they touch on, you know, Bezos not only owns, I think it's about 15% of Amazon, he has investments in dozens of different companies and startups. He owns the Blue Origin company, which, you know, space exploration and the like. He takes a huge amount of risks on his investments. He funds health and medical companies. He loses money on a lot of his investments, just like any of the other wealthy people. And so, of course, you can offset, you know, income from your successful businesses with losses from your unsuccessful ones. But that's what a market economy is. We want wealthy people to take the risks, to invest in the new businesses and industries of tomorrow. It's a very risky game, and I'm glad that wealthy people are using their money to take these big risks, and of course they lose money often, and we don't, you know, they shouldn't pay taxes if they're losing money. Let me put one more statistic on this. I was just looking this up this morning. You can look up IRS 2018, the most recent tax returns. They look at all. There are 22,112 people who earned more than $10 million. A year in 2018. Of the 22,112 returns, 22,094 of those were taxable. In other words, only less than 100, it looks like, didn't pay tax of that very top group of people who earned more than $10 million. So in other words, virtually all the people at the top paid tax. So, you know, it's a rare situation that someone at the top is that, you know, has enough losses that they, you know, wipes completely out their taxable income.
Right. And this gets back to the other problem with ProPublica. And by the way, I want to emphasize one thing. Whoever leaked this information should be first off, should be found. The IRS's computer systems are supposed to track access to individual tax returns, precisely to prevent this type of unauthorized release of information. So I know that Attorney General Merrick Garland said that investigating this leak was at the top of his list. He told that to Congress, I believe, 2 days ago. It really shouldn't be that difficult to track this down if you've got 25 different tax returns that were all accessed by the same individual that got released. I can't imagine that there's a large universe of people who touched all 25 of those tax returns.
Here's what's scary, though, is that, well, you know, there's 25 that ProPublica mentioned. How do we know this person hasn't taken the tax returns for hundreds of thousands of Americans? There was a scandal a number of years ago in Britain that I blogged about at Cato. In a revenue authority in Britain lost a thumb drive with a quarter of the tax returns of all people in the UK on a thumb drive. Appalling. So how do we know this isn't going on at the IRS? How do we know that there aren't a lot of IRS employees grabbing hundreds or even thousands of tax returns and sticking them on thumb drives and walking away? I mean, it's a dangerous thing, these leaks. And you're right. We have to get to the bottom of this.
And what I was going to also add to this is I'm not suggesting that ProPublica should be criminally charged or prosecuted or even sued, although perhaps the individuals involved in this will want to sue. But I suspect that that would be throwing a lot of, you know, good money after bad, so to speak. And these guys are probably smarter than that with their money to keep from doing that. They didn't commit a crime, but arguably they're incentivizing not just this crime, but further crime as well. And that's a moral and ethical issue. It's not a legal issue. It's a moral and ethical issue. And that's one of the reasons why, if it was some outfit that just didn't have any any value as a media outlet, it might be easier to oddly enough, might be easier to shrug off. But ProPublica has done some pretty good work in the past. This is a really bad decision, and it's something they're out there defending it, and they really need to stop defending this.
I agree with you exactly on that. I think some of their work has been really good, and I think they really tarnished themselves on this. I think it was a terrible decision from ProPublica to go ahead with this sort of story. And, you know, and not only did they present all the stolen data, the spin on the story was just, frankly, it was an absurdity. They stressed this idea that anyone who has some sort of paper appreciation increase in the value of their business ought to pay tax on it. So let's say you start a high-tech business, and the value 1 year is $100 million, the value the next year, it's gone up to $120 million. The ProPublica story is sort of hinting that you ought to pay tax on that $20 million paper appreciation in the value of your business, which is ridiculous.
You'd have to sell part of your business in order to pay the taxes, which would
do none of us any benefit. I mean, we all benefit when wealthy people who own businesses like Jeff Bezos keep their money invested in the business. I mean, Amazon employs over 1 million people now. So Bezos' ownership on paper of this company keeps all those people employed, produces GDP for the economy. That is all good, and we don't want to discourage that.
We're speaking with Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute about the ProPublica argument on taxes. We'll take your calls when we come back. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com. Stay tuned.
Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Get the facts without the spin.
The spin.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and at relevantradio.com.
It's 49 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We're speaking with Chris Edwards, Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute and editor of the website downsizinggovernment.org. Cato.org is where you can find the blog that he writes. And he's got a great post up regarding the actual tax data around the ProPublica argument, I guess you could call it, the argument that's based on the manipulative release of a tiny fraction of the universe of wealthy taxpayers, and more or less designed to present a very misleading picture of what our tax policy actually produces. And Chris, I mean, we've already seen the results of this, sort of this class warfare-ish kind of coverage at ProPublica. You mentioned this earlier. You've got members of Congress talking about wealth tax. We need to impose a wealth tax in order to capture this missing income. There's really no income missing here, but is there a fairness issue in the American tax code? And if there is, how do you solve it?
Well, look, there are some deductions and exemptions and the like at the top end that I would be happy to get rid of. One is, for example, the interest earned on municipal bonds is completely tax exempt. And so it's rich people who, you can look at the data on this, it's very slanted toward the top end. I remember John Kerry's wife, Theresa Hines Kerry, when I think some data about her tax returns came out, and they invested heavily in tax free muni bonds. And so what happens when the tax rates at the top go up? Rich people put more of their money in tax free muni bonds. Well, I would get rid of that exemption, for example. So I think there are things we can do to make it so that at the high end we have a more even and flat a code, so that it's harder for high end people to use loopholes and the like. I'm all for that. But, you know, when you look at the overall data, the vast majority of people at the top end pay much higher tax rates. And just to give you the bottom line numbers here on the ProPublica says, if looking at income and payroll tax, that a typical worker pays 19%, and these top 25 pay 16% rate on their income and payroll tax. So the middle income worker supposedly pays a little bit more than the top end. But authoritative data from the Congressional Budget Office says middle income folks pay on average 12% in income and payroll tax. The top 1% at the highest income, they pay 27%. So the ProPublica returns were very atypical. Maybe they raised some issues about some machinations that some wealthy people do to avoid taxes, and we should have a discussion about those. But you know, the overall idea that the rich people get away like bandits is not true.
We're talking with Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Let's go to the phone. Great, Craig, welcome to the show.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up that Donald Trump, they had a whole firestorm on his tax returns during and before the election, and it doesn't seem anybody's talking about that. He said he spent what he made, and he didn't have to pay taxes because of it. And I understand that's how the way it works.
All right, Craig. Well, thank you.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think there's still some. I think there's still some courts that are still going after and trying to get Trump's tax returns released. But I'm not sure where that stands today. But and it is true that the real estate industry, there are certain breaks the real estate industry gets. That's Trump's industry, of course, and he was able to avoid paying taxes some year, I think, because he had a lot of losses that you're allowed to carry forward and offset your current year's taxes. The Republicans actually reformed the business loss rules in their 2017 tax bill and tightened those rules, actually. I've argued that, one advantage in consumption-based taxes is that if you get at everyone equally. If rich people are going out and spending money on a lot of yachts and houses and that sort of stuff, you would hit them with a consumption-based tax. And sometimes there are loopholes under the income tax where they can't avoid tax. But I think, the solution is tax reform to create a more even playing field across the board.
And of course, sometimes what you're seeing in this is that some of the very wealthiest people don't get a lot of income. They've structured their finances so that their income level is relatively low, to their overall wealth and in relation to their overall wealth. Obviously, you're still getting some income, but because they have to be able to have money to spend. But those are the types of things that you get when you're dealing with a very complicated tax system. We have a very complicated tax system. I know that the Cato Institute, there's a lot of analysis about this, and we have a complicated tax system in part because we are trying to do what I would call social engineering through the tax code. And you mentioned muni bonds, right? The exemption that you're talking about was in theory a good idea because lawmakers wanted to encourage investment in municipals, right? And municipals tend to be very boring investments. munis tend to be boring, but cities need money, and so they issue these bonds trying to raise money for various different capital projects, and they need people to buy those bonds. And so Congress, in its wisdom, decided that they wanted to make it more attractive, so they provided a tax exemption. The tax code is filled with good intentions, and I use that phrase very deliberately because I think it's sort of been the road to hell when it comes to debates over tax policy.
You're exactly right. Indeed, I remember vividly. I remember about 16, 17 years ago when Enron Corporation crashed and burned. They were doing all kinds of financial accounting fraud and the like. They were avoiding taxes like crazy. And the Congressional Tax Joint Committee on Tax came out with this really fat two-inch thick report on what they had done with their tax machinations. I read the whole thing. It was pretty painful. But what the bottom line was, they actually were not breaking the law with all these tax machinations. They were using selective little pieces that were sprinkled all over the tax code that were put in place for good reasons. And they combine them together in really complicated ways to avoid taxes. So you're absolutely right. Members of Congress, they all want to put exemptions and the like in for their own industry and their own special favorite activities. But then, of course, the tax accountants in the private sector get to work and combine a lot of these different loopholes and exemptions and help businesses and sometimes wealthy individuals, you know, avoid paying tax. Again, the solution then is to create more of a level playing field to get members of Congress to withhold this drive they have to create loopholes for their favorite industries. And but that's, you know, it's a hard thing to do. I mean, the 2017 Republican tax bill tried to eliminate some of these exemptions, but really, you know, only went so far. And there's a lot more work to do.
Yeah, I mean, if you're concerned about paying a fair share. One way to do that is just to have everybody pay the same rate. We got about 20 seconds. I'll let you respond to that, Chris.
No, that's absolutely right. I would have a big, the idea of the flat tax that was much debated in the 1990s and talked about by folks like Steve Forbes. You have a large basic exemption, so people below some level didn't pay any tax, and above that, you just have a flat even rate, basically on all income. Period. Bang. That's it. A lot harder for people to avoid and to cheat. Be fair. You know, the problem today is you put loopholes in and the rates go up. The higher rates are, the more of an incentive it is for businesses and wealthy people to cheat. And so, you know, raising rates is going to create this, you know, make a lot more problems. And
exactly.
An example of that is,
Chris, we're going to have to
double a capital gains tax rate. That will cause huge amounts of avoidance activity.
Chris Edwards from the Cato Institute. We have to leave it right there. Thanks for being with us. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.